From downtown Pittsburgh, you can see where the Allegheny and Monongahela Rivers meet to form the headwaters of the Ohio River. At nearly 1,000 miles long, the Ohio flows from Pennsylvania through five other states to the Mississippi River. Along its banks, you might see green landscapes and fishing spots.
My wife is actually catching fish out here with the kids. It's kind of cool to see the fish coming back into the area.
But it's also lined with industry, factories, and power plants.
My dad told me, find something else to do, but don't work in a chemical plant.
The Environmental Protection Agency says the Ohio is the most polluted river in the U.S., but many towns and cities are banking on cleaning it up for redevelopment.
Because frankly, you're selling the river, whether it's an office building or it's residential.
And showcasing the beauty of this abundant natural resource.
As rowers, we are pretty darn lucky to have a view of the city and a view of our area from the water. We love our rivers.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we launch a new series with our partners at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. It's called Headwaters. Stay with us. River recreation, flooding, pollution, drinking water. These are all pieces of a puzzle that make up the Ohio River watershed. How do we begin fitting them together into a plan for the future? In our first Headwaters story, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant wades into this question.
When you live in the Ohio River headwaters, hearing newscasts like this isn't too surprising.
Dozens of people are homeless after floodwaters destroyed their homes.
Or even hearing comments like this one from Pittsburgh triathlete Sarah Kaysen after a heavy rain.
I don't think anybody wants poop in the river. People are like, oh, it must just be rain runoff. Yes, it is. It is also raw, untreated sewage. It's gross. It's really gross.
Recent years have also brought news of chemical spills and algae blooms. But what if the river wasn't a problem to be dealt with and instead essential to the region's health and economic future? What might that look like? Let's go to this party to get an idea. It's at a restaurant in the heart of a busy urban riverfront park. This is a who's who in water. Researchers, technology geeks, water treatment experts, political and business leaders. Everyone's talking about how water fits into the region's economic development plans. But we're not in Pittsburgh. This is the first annual meeting of Cleveland's Water Alliance. Cleveland, of course, is home to the infamous Burning River and Lake Erie, known for toxic green algae in recent years. But Cleveland's ahead when it comes to putting a value on its water and how to leverage it to benefit the region. Alliance Executive Director Brian Stubbs says their efforts are already paying off.
Now we're starting to see the investment community pay attention. So what we're trying to do is to get private capital engaged in this space. No longer is it a lift of just the state or just the city or just a watershed group. We're now trying to figure out and having conversations with big money.
So look, tonight's about the organization.
Stubbs told Water Alliance members that their region has added more than 200 water technology jobs. They've got patents in the works. They're even launching a large-scale competition in cities around the Great Lakes to spur innovation in water technology. So if Cleveland's starting to bring in big money around its water, why can't the Ohio River watershed get similar action? Community planner Jerry Paytas with the consulting firm Fourth Economy looked into water's role in this region's economy.
I don't think it's top of mind. It's not something that people are thinking about. So in that regard, we're not really valuing what the water can mean to us long term.
The report he co-authored in 2011 found that water was already having a big economic impact. 3,000 firms were providing components, products, and services for the water industry, water supplies for agriculture, food processing, thermoelectric plants, and the energy industry supported more than $24 billion in the area's economy. The report also found that the region and the Ohio River headwaters has a unique opportunity to use its industrial strengths to grow a variety of water-related industries. But no one's coordinating a vision for the future of water in this region.
It's been referred to as the Wild West because there's no management of water.
Deborah Lang is in charge of special environmental projects at Carnegie Mellon University. After Paytas' report came out, she helped facilitate a committee of experts from Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio a few years ago. Their goal?
Start to get the Headwaters region, which stretches all the way up into New York, prepared for the future of water.
But that effort largely stalled. There just wasn't much interest in a multi-state effort to create a vision for the watershed.
Probably the biggest hurdle, and probably why we've been at this for 20 years, is that nobody wants another layer of regulation, approval, fees.
Lang says there are already plenty of groups and agencies working on water issues in the Headwaters region. On the state level, environmental agencies approve water withdrawals and regulate pollution.
So the Department of Environmental Protection might be granting permits.
There's the U.S. Army Corps.
The Corps of Engineers is monitoring water flow and managing their locks and dams.
There's a group called RAIN.
RAIN is collecting real-time water quality data.
And then there's ORSANCO.
Their compact has them worry about water quality in the entire Ohio River Basin. There's no coordination of all of that. So we have a lot of pieces of the puzzle that are working. We're close. But we just kind of need that little push to begin to coordinate.
This isn't a new concept. Other watersheds have been doing it for decades. There's the Great Lakes Compact, which spells out who can take water and how much. The Susquehanna River, the Delaware River, the Chesapeake Bay all have multi-state commissions with planning authority, but not the Ohio River. And climate change could make that even more important. As some areas become increasingly parched, the Ohio Headwaters region is expected to see bigger rainfalls and more water.
Since we're a water-rich area, a water-poor area could, in essence, stick a straw into the water there at the point and begin extracting water.
There's no one lining up to suck up the Ohio River, at least not right now, but Lang says the region should be preparing. Community planner Jerry Paytas agrees, and for him, it's about the economy. Just look at tech companies like Google and Facebook. When they're recruiting new employees to the region, they need quality drinking water and a river clean enough for recreation.
If we don't manage the water withdrawals, if we don't manage the water quality, is going to be very difficult to add people or grow the economy. So it may not be so much of an economic driver, but it surely will become an economic break.
Paytas' 2011 report did not recommend a new water organization, but it did call for a multi-state task force or council to coordinate planning of the region's water resources. And as thirst for water grows around the world, he says the need for this is becoming increasingly important. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
For more perspective on this idea of valuing water and regional planning to harness water resources, we turn to Colin O'Mara, president of the National Wildlife Federation. His organization is trying to raise the importance of investing in water, from lead contamination in Flint to flooding in North Carolina and Louisiana. I spoke with O'Mara by phone from Washington, D.C., and asked what the National Wildlife Federation is doing in the Ohio River region.
One of the things that we're seeing is that there have been amazing investments made in the Great Lakes. There's been big investments made in the Chesapeake, but these investments tend to be in places that are seen as kind of destinations. Folks plan vacations, folks, you know, retire to some of these places. These are places where folks in some cases have second homes, but we're not seeing the same level of investment in kind of what I would consider like the working waterways, you know, places like the Allegheny leading into the Ohio River Valley, places like the Delaware River. 25 million people live in the Ohio River Valley Basin. I mean, that's, you know, almost a tenth of the country. And yet we've seen virtually no investment of federal resources, at least, in trying to clean up the legacy pollution. I mean, the Ohio is still the most polluted waterway in the entire country. So we've been working with some of the mayors, working with some of the different advocacy groups in the region, trying to begin talking about the Ohio River as a system, as a vision for the entire watershed. You know, there's been some good work in places like the Beaver River. There's a lot of individual groups. There's a bunch of groups in Kentucky that are working on the Green or the Cumberland. And what we're trying to do is actually try to unite those voices and actually trying to have a vision. So, you know, folks are as excited about kind of restoring these iconic waterways that in many ways help build our country as they are about, you know, individual economic development projects that may be coming along the pipeline.
You mentioned the economy. It seems like the most exciting thing that's happening along the Ohio recently is the ethane cracker that Shell is planning to build near Pittsburgh. You know, people are excited about the jobs and the economic development around that. In areas where there's more regional planning around water resources, what other kinds of considerations are part of the equation to value, you know, to how to use the water to create the best future for the region beyond industry?
So often in places that are kind of working waterways, we basically treat, you know, these water bodies as simply a support for these larger kind of industrial facilities. And you see it with crackers or refineries or different places. And those jobs are important, right? I mean, it's important to have jobs. And obviously, we want to be transitioning to a clean energy future and kind of reducing overall emissions. But we don't value the kind of the opportunity cost and the economic loss when you do degrade these waterways. Right now across America, the outdoor economy is about a $646 billion economy. It employs more than 6 million people. And that puts it on par with many of the largest industries in the country. A lot of those are water-dependent jobs related to fishing or swimming or different types of outdoor water-related activities. And so one of the cases we're trying to make is that it doesn't have to be either or. The technologies exist now that you can actually have, you know, some industrial facilities and still not have to contaminate the waterway as a trade-off. The old dichotomy of having to choose between the economy or the environment really isn't true. And there's places in the country that are making those choices that they want both.
Can you imagine a future scenario where Pittsburgh is more like the Chesapeake Bay, where it's more of a recreational hub and people see this as a viable alternative to more industry?
There are amazing opportunities. It's the reason why Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, chose Falling Water and, you know, kind of the amazing resources just south of you guys as a place to build his flagship structures. And so, I mean, there are beautiful things in western Pennsylvania, and most of them relate to water. And so I think having more kind of regional pride and having greater value placed upon the importance of those assets at least lays a foundation for this becoming a greater priority. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And it's not something that any individual city or any individual, even individual governor can do. If you can actually build these coalitions, they become nonpartisan in a way that it becomes simply a value and it becomes an ongoing priority. All of a sudden, the typical fights in Harrisburg or the typical fights in Washington begin to subside. I mean, I'll just tell you one quick story. A few years ago, the President Obama proposed a reduction in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding. There was such bipartisan outrage that it was immediately put back actually higher than what the original budget amount was. Given the political power that's in the region between Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, I mean, you have leaders in both sides of the aisle. You have some of the top Republican leaders in the country, and guys like Rob Portman in Ohio and the Senate Majority Leader McConnell in Kentucky. I mean, you have some of the most important people in Washington that live along this watershed that if we were able to make it a higher priority for them, there is no reason why significant investment isn't going into the region.
So are you getting buy-in from some of the people you've been talking to about these kinds of issues?
I am. I mean, I think that the challenge is that there's a little bit of disbelief. It's almost like they can't envision what it could be. I'd say I'm getting a fairly lukewarm reception, but no one's slamming a door in my face, but no one also is kind of jumping to the front of the line saying we absolutely have to do this right now.
You know, you allude to an interesting point, which is that Pittsburgh is not like some of the other smaller towns along the Ohio River, which are not seeing the technology and innovation. There are a lot of other things going on in Pittsburgh that have helped fuel the revitalization of the riverfronts that may not be happening in other parts of the Ohio River Valley.
I have a lot of friends that went to Pitt and Carnegie Mellon. I mean, there's, you know, so much talent, right, in that region, and so much engineering talent in particular that, I mean, I do think that the right kind of spark in Pittsburgh, you could actually kind of light, you know, kind of activity across the entire region. But like you said, I mean, Pittsburgh does have a much more diversified economy than a lot of places that were, you know, mainly depending on, you know, coal extraction or other types of kind of natural resources. I mean, I view this as a great opportunity to, you know, invest in those areas that need it most, hopefully give folks skills and economic opportunities they might not otherwise have. If we can actually restore some of the scarring on the landscape from some of the past extraction and clean up some of the mines and at the same time clean up the waterways, you got hundreds of thousands of jobs potentially, you know, hundreds of thousands of potential permanent jobs in the kind of wise stewardship of them and through industries and breweries and tourism outfitters. I mean, there's a ton of opportunities if we do this the right way. And there's no reason that there's nothing stopping that from happening other than kind of a lack of focus and a lack of investment.
Why is regional water planning an important issue for the National Wildlife Federation? And why is it a national issue?
You know, when we're trying to address the magnitude of the challenges that we're going to be facing as a country in the years ahead, when you think about, you know, issues around climate or issues around, you know, drought, our long-term salvation in many ways, and I think the economic underpinning of a lot of our economy could be rooted in our natural resources, and particularly water. You know, it's great to talk about the Chesapeake and the Great Lakes. A water body like the Ohio and like the Delaware is actually more relevant to conversations that we're having in like the upper parts of the Mississippi or in the Missouri or even some of the issues in the Mississippi River Delta. And frankly, if we can show progress in the Ohio River Valley, if we can get it done there, if we can get it done in a place that's had a lot of legacy pollution, both from industry and from coal facilities and mines and things like that, we can basically make water work anywhere. And so for me, I mean, it's not just about the wildlife and the habitat and the short-term gains. It's really about showing that as a country, we care about these resources. And by investing them today, we're going to set ourselves up for, you know, another American century and not simply be strangled by the kind of the sins of the past and the mistakes that we made before. But we can really use water as a way to revitalize communities across the country.
Colin O'Mara, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Colin O'Mara is the president of the National Wildlife Federation. Next week, our series Headwaters continues when we explore the fallout from legacy pollution in one Ohio River community. You can find all of the stories from our new Headwaters series delving into the future of the Ohio River's vast water resources at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. When you live along the river, kind of on the edge of the grid and everything else, you have time to think. And that leads to some water-related wisdom.
If you use your boat all the time, and you really just suck the recreational marrow out of that boat, then it doesn't matter what you pay for the boat. It's worth it 100%.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, stories from the banks of the Ohio. Don't miss the boat. Stay tuned. Here's a common sound on Friday nights at high schools all over the country. Fall football, as well as autumn soccer leagues, get kids and communities outside for fresh air and fun. But recently, some have been questioning the wholesomeness of the athletic fields kids are playing on. Nationwide, about 11,000 artificial turf fields include a material called crumb rubber. Journalist Mary Niederberger looked into the use of these crumb rubber pellets for Public Source, our investigative news partner, and she joins me now. Mary, what is crumb rubber, and what's the main concern about its use?
Well, it's tiny rubber pellets that are made from old tires, and they put them in the artificial turf surfaces. It works great to cushion falls. It's in between the artificial blades of grass, and in the beginning, everybody thought this was win-win. It recycled rubber because they didn't want to put tires in a landfill or burn them where they released carcinogens, and it made artificial turf softer, so that's how it's used.
But there are some concerns about health issues surrounding it.
Yes, these concerns emanated from a soccer coach in the state of Washington who also was on the Olympic soccer team. And as she coached and she kept in touch with players, she started to notice that more and more of them were being diagnosed with lymphoma. And the other thing that she noticed is that a lot of them were goalies. And she started to wonder if the amount of time that goalies spend diving, because on just about every play during practice and in a game, they're diving into the turf. What the belief is that if it is causing an illness, it's because the rubber may be embedding itself into scrapes. There are abrasions playing on the surface. So if the rubber is embedding itself there or into an athlete's nostrils or ears, that the chemicals are able to seep into the body. So at first she just kept the list for herself. Then she went to the media with it. It grew. ESPN did a big piece on it. I think there are more than 200 people on it now because there were other soccer players on the list and they're football players.
And there's a federal inquiry that launched in February.
Yes. It started because there were two senators who wrote a letter to President Barack Obama asking for this inquiry. And he then ordered the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission to study various aspects of this crumb rubber and whether or not it could be related to the illnesses.
Now, you found a number of local schools and communities here in the Pittsburgh area have spent a lot of money recently, millions altogether, installing artificial turf that uses crumb rubber. Why? If there are questions about its safety, what are the schools and the athletic associations that are using this saying about it?
You know, that's a really interesting question. The thing that surprised me is the schools that were putting it in are the higher income districts. I Googled around to see if any of them had discussions, and I found there were a few. And there were, I think it was Chartiers Valley, and there was another district in the North Hills, I think it was Shaler, that had the discussion and decided to use alternate pellets. One used virgin rubber, which has never been in tires. Another used cryogenic rubber, which is frozen and somehow purified in the freezing process. The others said that no one brought any health concerns to them, and that's why they went ahead and put it in. Since then, I've heard from a phys ed teacher in one of the districts who said the gym teachers brought this to the attention of the administration. They sent them the ESPN video, and the school district went ahead and put it in anyhow.
Did you speak with parents, and are they concerned?
The mom who was the lead in my story is very concerned about it, but her son's an avid soccer player, and she hates it. It's in her house. She said when he gets changed in the bathroom, it just lays in piles on the floor, but he doesn't want to stop playing soccer. When her district replaced their field this year, she was hoping they would get rid of it. But I've heard in other districts that the sports leagues really like these fields, especially over a grass field. When artificial turf first came out, only what would be considered the affluent districts would be able to afford to put it in. But I think over the years, it may have become more affordable. I think even districts that don't have a lot of resources see that it costs less money to maintain one of these fields, and it can be used over and over and over again. When you have a grass field, it wears down over time. If you have a rainy season, you've got to cancel, reschedule games. Whereas if you have these artificial turf surfaces, there's not a drainage issue. They can be used all day long by all different kinds of leagues. And the other plus that districts will tell you is that they don't have to use pesticides on these fields. And I remember covering school districts back in, you know, the 90s, and that was the big deal. Parents were coming to school board meetings and complaining about the pesticides that were being used on school property.
As your piece mentions, the artificial turf industry says that crumb rubber is perfectly safe. And we should be clear that there hasn't been a direct link shown between the use of crumb rubber and cancer or any other health issues, right?
That's correct, although I will tell you, no one from the turf industry would speak to me directly.
What about medical professionals or health professionals? Have they weighed in on this?
We had a medical professional. He's a hematologist, so he studies lymphoma, but he's also an environmental toxicologist, and he worked for the EPA at one point in time. And he said he understands exactly why the EPA would study this, because it involves kids and illness. But he said, based on what he knows about lymphoma, he doesn't see a direct link between the chemicals that he's aware of in the rubber and a direct link to lymphoma. He thinks it's unlikely, but it's not a 0% chance that there's a connection. And he said, in the meantime, play on the fields, but get out of your gear and take a shower as soon as possible and make sure all of the rubber pellets are off of you until the jury's in on whether or not they're safe.
So minimize your exposure.
Exactly.
Well, Mary, thanks.
Okay.
Mary Niederberger is a freelance journalist who covers youth and education in Pittsburgh. Her full story about crumb rubber athletic fields for Public Source, our investigative news partner, is at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. And a link to that ESPN video we mentioned is there too. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
This ain't no game right here. It's more like religion. We built this thing right here, a football tradition. So everybody get up and feast your eyes on the highlight of small town life. It's Friday night.
We heard about some issues facing the Ohio River earlier. But finally today, we've got a more buoyant story about an aspect of life on the river, boating culture. And few have a closer perspective on it than this Pittsburgher, who lives year-round at a marina on the Ohio.
My name's Jason Fleming. I live on the North Shore of Pittsburgh, PA, and I'm the resident manager of Newport Marina. You know, on paper, it doesn't sound like a great deal. I live in a 40-foot trailer with extended pop-outs.
You know, the running joke amongst all my friends, and I've had to own it because you can't avoid it, is I live in a van down by the river. The fact that I have a 20-foot by 20-foot deck that's right on the water, and what I guess I would describe as kind of a carefree bohemian lifestyle, that makes it all worth it. Somebody asked me the other day what was the weirdest thing I saw on the river, and I had to think about it, and then I came up with it. It was the 4th of July a couple years ago, and at some point, some knucklehead got a little tiny like rowboat with an outboard motor, and it was just him and his very pregnant girlfriend on the boat. At one point, I heard some commotion and looked out. The boyfriend had fallen or jumped out of the boat, I don't know why, leaving his pregnant and now panicking girlfriend in the boat with the outboard motor stuck, apparently, at full throttle and in a full turning position. So now the rowboat is doing very loud, very aggressive concentric circles in the river. And people were slowly thinking, well, how's this going to end? And can we do anything? But nobody was really going out of their way to come up with a plan. Until those concentric circles that the boat was going in started getting closer and closer to some very expensive cabin cruisers. And suddenly that passive curiosity turned into like SEAL Team 6 brainstorming. And everybody suddenly had a plan because they didn't want their boats touched. And what ultimately happened was a brave young soul got on the back of a jet ski, not a Wave Runner, not a Sea-Doo, one of those old school jet skis, took it out to her, and in what was admittedly a very impressive feat, jumped from the jet ski onto this boat that's turning in circles, TJ Hooker style, got in the boat, and immediately turned off the engine and saved the day. Mind you, he was not the person who saved the day, the boyfriend. I don't know if that relationship stood the test of time, as he jumped out and left her on the boat. Boating is a subculture, like any other subculture. It's like kind of a weird fraternity. People talk about the expense of the boat, how the two happiest days in a boat owner's life is the day they buy the boat and the day they sell the boat. For those people who don't use their boat frequently, no amount of money is worth it. If you use your boat all the time, and you really just suck the recreational marrow out of that boat, then it doesn't matter what you pay for the boat. It's worth it 100%. And the people who use it all the time tend to create their own little community here on the river. On any given football Sunday or Kenny Chesney concert or 4th of July fireworks, you'll find people from 5, 6, 7 different marinas all down by the point. They've, you know, tied their boats off together in a giant flotilla, party flotilla, and they just love it. I don't know, it's the perfect way to not be at work and not be at home for them. The escape is the river. Surprisingly, for someone who lives on the river, I don't own a boat. But 5 times a week minimum, every week of the year, somebody comes by, "Do you live here?" "Yes." "Oh my God, that is the coolest thing in the world. I wish I could live here." And they all typically are people with wives and kids and responsibilities, and they see this as what I see it as, actually, is a wonderful escape in the middle of the city.
That was Jason Fleming. He's the resident manager of Newport Marina on the Ohio River. His story is one of many by producer Lou Bluen, documenting the unique people that shape life on the Three Rivers. For more, motor over to AlleghenyFront.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.